Boker Tov, everybody. Welcome. It's 11 a.m. in Toronto, 10 a.m. in Chicago, where Dr. Malka Simcovich is located. And it's a pleasure to welcome you back to Torah in Motion. Spoke a number of years ago on our Tanakh Yom Iyun, but this is your first presentation on Zoom. Malka is the Crown Ryan Chair of Jewish Studies and the Director of the Catholic Jewish Studies Program at Catholic Theological Union in Chicago. She's an expert on Second Temple Judaism. She's the author of, among other books, Discovering Second Temple Literature, the Scriptures and the Stories that Shaped Early Judaism. And I think she's a perfect fit for our Hanukkah series. And it's a pleasure to welcome her for our learning this morning. Thank you very much. It's all yours, Malka.
Thank you very much. I'm very happy to be here. I hope that you're all having a wonderful holiday and that you and your loved ones are healthy and well. I'm going to start with a binary that we're all so familiar with, a binary that our children learn at a very young age. And that is this idea that there are two stories about Hanukkah that are really at the root of its history. One, of course, is the military victory from 175 to 164 BCE, the war which culminates in the great Hasmonean victory over the Antiochid Greeks. And of course, the other version of the story is a theological story. It's a story about a miracle of miraculous light which is only meant to last one day, but lasts 8 days. And this story is only preserved about 700 years after the war in a 5th or 6th century CE Talmudic passage. And so it's very tempting to put these traditions in opposition to one another, almost as if they're in competition, right? We have two strains of the story. We have this military strain, we have the theological strain, and then you could develop the binary by saying, well, maybe it's a binary of Second Temple approaches. Excuse me, hold on. Second Temple approaches versus rabbinic approaches. And originally the story was a military one. And then the rabbis theologize it with a miracle story. And so this is usually how people understand the earliest retellings of the Hanukkah story, the military version versus the theological miracle version, which emphasizes God's everlasting commitment to the covenantal relationship. Now, in fact, this is entirely false. And what we're going to do in the next hour is try to undermine this binary. And we're going to begin by showing that right after the war, in 164 BCE, at the earliest possible stage, as Jews are retelling the story and trying to make sense of it, they're asking right away, what does this mean to us theologically? What is the meaning of this story that should compel us to commemorate it every year for perpetuity, whether we witnessed the war or not? And so it's not the rabbis in the 5th or 6th century who say, you know what, we're not totally comfortable with valorizing warriors. This really has to have some sort of transcendent theological message. In fact, this is happening basically right away in the 2nd century BCE. And so what are our eyewitnesses, what are our oldest sources for the Hanukkah story, and how do they theologize the story? How do they attribute meaning to this war in a way which culminates in a universal miracle, universal holiday, which is celebrated for two millennia? Well, the problem right now that we have with our sources is that we only really have one eyewitness to the story, just one. There are two books of Maccabees that are written in the end of the 2nd century BCE, but just one of those books is an eyewitness. And that's all. We don't have anything else. We have Josephus at the end of the 1st century CE. Of course, we have the rabbinic literature. But in terms of a source written by someone who was there, who watched the events unfold around him, we have just one source. And that is one Maccabees. And so when we talk about the books of Maccabees, we can't put them into conversation with one another as if they're equally reliable. One Maccabees is written in Judea, probably in Jerusalem, in Hebrew, commissioned by the Hashmonai, the Hasmonean dynasty. And two Maccabees is a diasporan work, certainly written originally in Greek, probably in Cyrene, in modern-day Libya, by an individual who likely never was ever even in Judea, using sources, oral and written, available to him. And so it's a totally different book. And these books tell the story in two different ways. And some of these differences are quite challenging. In 1 Maccabees, the enemy is primarily those Jews who are assimilating. In 2 Maccabees, the enemy primarily is Hellenism as a culture, which is hurtling into imminent conflict with Judaism. In 1 Maccabees, the holiday that commemorates the victory of the Hasmoneans in 164 BC is a newly established holiday. It's new. All it does, its only function, is to commemorate this victory. Not so in 2 Maccabees. We're going to see when I share my screen that in 2 Maccabees, this is actually not a new holiday. It's an old holiday that is now reincorporating new events. In other words, the Hasmonean victory, but it's actually stemming from an older holiday. So we have these two very different books. Neither of them have a story about the miracle of the oil. But I'm going to suggest that at a very early stage, there are stories of miracles that associate light and oil and some kind of miracle having to do with light in the temple, and that these stories are circulating probably as early as the 2nd century BCE. So we're going to share the screen over here. And here I have a timeline, which I'm maybe going to go back to, but I'm going to start with 1 Maccabees. Again, this is a highly significant work because it's the only eyewitness to this story. That doesn't mean that it's objective. I have over here a title, A Straightforward, Albeit Biased History, from the late 2nd century BC. And why is it biased? Well, I told you earlier it's commissioned, probably, by the Hasmonean family. And the reason why scholars think this is because it is very, very focused on the heroic adventures of the Hasmoneans in a very, very positive way. Now, by the time we get to the 140s or 130s BCE, the Hasmonean family is already corrupt and many of them are Hellenized. And so this is a polemical work arguing for the legitimacy of the Hasmonean, the Hashmonai family. We're not going to see a parallel interest in the Hashmonai in 2 Maccabees. In 2 Maccabees, it's about God, the welfare of Jerusalem, and the welfare of the temple. The Hashmonai are merely the media, merely the tools which God uses to effect the victory. But in 1 Maccabees, the focus is really on these heroes, the Hasmonean family. When the story opens, the author makes it clear that the primary enemy in the book, the primary antagonist who causes all the problems, they're not outsider Greeks, they're actually Jews. Many from Israel gladly adopted the religion of Antiochus or Epiphanes. They sacrificed to idols, they profaned the Sabbath. So it's these Judeans who are abandoning their ancestral laws and embracing the practices of the Seleucid Greeks that are the real problem. And many of these people, the Jewish people, everyone who forsook the law, joined Antiochus for Epiphanes. They did evil in the land. They drove Israel into hiding in every place of refuge they had. And we're going to see in 2 Maccabees, the second version of the story is actually much less interested in such Jews. But this is important because when you read 2 Maccabees, you're going to see a word that is never used before in Jewish pietistic literature. And that word is Judaism. It is not a word that appears in earlier sources, Judaismos. And it's pitted against Hellenismos in such a way as to argue that to be a pious Jew committed to one's ancestral laws means that you must oppose Hellenism. Now, this is a polemical argument given the reality that Jews are living under Hellenism as early as 323 BCE with the death of Alexander the Great. And so they're living for 150 years under Greek culture. So to argue that Judaism and Hellenism are hurtling towards one another in an imminent culture clash is an argument that has to be made to Jews who've actually been peacefully living under Greek culture for so long. And this is not the argument that one Maccabees makes. This is the argument that two Maccabees makes. But I want to take you to the towards the end of the story when the temple is recovered and the holiday of Hanukkah, it's not called Hanukkah yet, but the holiday is established by the Hasmoneans as it is retold in this one eyewitness account of the story. So again, I mentioned earlier that this holiday in 1 Maccabees is depicted as a new holiday and it is depicted as an old holiday in other sources. But what do we see over here? In early in the morning on the 25th day of the ninth month, the month of Kislev, in the 148th year, they're counting down from the beginning of the Seleucid Empire. So this takes us to 164 BCE. Again, you know, they're not working down towards the year zero. There is no BCE, of course, but they're counting down from the beginning of the Seleucid age. They offer sacrifice on the new altar. And this occurs at the very season, on the very day that the Gentiles had profaned it. So the Gentiles, the Seleucid Greeks, had invaded the temple exactly on the 25th of Kislev 3 years earlier. And so it seems from this source that they're selecting the 25th of Kislev to come back and create this rededication. There's great joy among the people. And by the way, I should say parenthetically, I'm sure that there are many other shirim you could hear about the connection between this date and the second chapter of Haggai, which states that the 25th of Kislev is the day upon which the foundation of the second temple was built. And that is very significant. It's not the focus of this talk, but I'm happy to come back to it if we're going to have a Q&A session. But it does seem that this date is intentionally selected because of its importance in Haggai. But the point here is, so what's this holiday? This holiday is, even though it has a significant date in Haggai, right? It's on the date upon which the foundation of the second temple was established. Still, it does seem like a holiday that is new in that it commemorates the victory of the Hashmonai family. And it doesn't really have a name, right? They're determined that every year at that season, the days of dedication of the altar should be observed with joy and gladness. We don't really have like a reference to Hanukkah. Days of dedication maybe is that reference, but we don't know because we don't have the original Hebrew of this work. But in any case, it does seem to be a newly established holiday. It has a military emphasis. This commemorates the victory of the Hasmoneans over the Seleucid Greeks. And the enemy is the Hellenized Jews primarily. Now, two Maccabees, we get a totally different picture. Remember, this is an author who's writing in the diaspora, and he is making a marketing campaign. He's engaged in a campaign to make an argument that all Jews, regardless of where they live, need to celebrate this holiday. And so how do you market such a holiday to Jews who are living throughout the Greco-Roman world, who might have heard of the war and they might have been aware of the victory, this unlikely victory of the Hashmonai family against the Seleucid Greeks, but they don't have a personal stake in the story, they were not eyewitnesses to the war. What kind of argument do you make to diasporan Jews to say this story involves you? Well, you can't emphasize the military aspect of the holiday. You have to theologize it. The argument has to be, this story is not about the Jews of Judea. This story is about all Jews, because it's a story which affirms God's protection and commitment to the Jewish people. And so today the miracle was in Judea, and tomorrow the miracle could be for you. Today God intervened miraculously in the affairs of Jews in Jerusalem. Tomorrow that same kind of intervention can take place in Alexandria, in Rome, in Antioch, or wherever Jews live. And so the theological argument is that God didn't just save the Judeans, God saved us. And 2 Maccabees is rife with miracles which make this argument. There are no miracles in 1 Maccabees, but 2 Maccabees is not interested in telling over a dry account of the conflict. 2 Maccabees is, interestingly, very stylistically Hellenized. Lots of miracles, lots of drama, pathos, prayer, soliloquy. The writer pulls out all the stops and uses all of his tricks in the book, writes a very, very high level Greek text to argue against the legitimacy of Hellenism. So the irony of this book is, again, it's written originally in Greek by someone who's clearly very well educated in Greek stylistics. And the great irony is he's using all these Hellenistic literary tricks to say Hellenism is bad. And in fact, it's so bad that it stands in opposition to Judaism, a word which had never been used, Judaismos. It's a category that stands outside of Hellenism. And in fact, I think that this is a very new idea and would have been strange to many Jews, just as I would find it strange if somebody were to ask me, are you an American or are you a Jew? I would have a hard time comprehending that question. Likewise, I think Jews living in the Greco-Roman diaspora would have been confused to be asked, are you Greek or are you Jewish? And yet that is the binary being established by this diasporan writer who is saying this is a story about an abstract cultural clash. And I sure hope that you're on the right side of this conflict. And so the story opens up with a little vignette, a little mini story, which actually foreshadows the entire book. And this is a common Hellenistic literary technique where you open up a big adventure tale, a big epic, with a little vignette that actually tells you the entire story. And that's what this little story is over here. The story opens up with a general named Heliodorus who is coming to pillage and empty the temple treasury in Jerusalem. And this is another literary motif among Jewish texts at this time, this idea that an outsider could violate the temple with an invasion. It appears in many texts, and it was a common fear, this violation, because at least by the first century, emperors are putting their own statues, likenesses of themselves in all kinds of temples. And in fact, in 38 CE, Gaius Caligula tries to do this with the Jerusalem temple, put a statue of himself in the temple, and the Jews absolutely freak out. But so in any case, we're talking about a much earlier work here. In this story, Heliodorus, a general who works for the Seleucid Greek army, shows up at the treasury of the Jerusalem temple with a bunch of his goons. And he says, I'm going to take what's mine. I'm going to take everything that's in the temple treasury. And so the Jews absolutely panic. And remember, as you read this, this is stylistically a Hellenist work, even though it's very pietistic. It's maybe even more pietistic than 1 Maccabees. So it's using Hellenistic stylistics, but it's extremely pietistic. So you have to sort of appreciate the literary elegance of this passage. There was no little distress throughout the whole city. The priests prostrated themselves before the altar in their priestly vestments and called towards heaven upon him who had given the law about deposits, that he should keep them safe for those who had deposited them. And again, you can almost imagine this being performed on a stage, the authors positioning every character. This person bends on his knees and raises his hands to God. It's sort of like instructions that a director would almost give somebody performing. To see the appearance of the high priest was to be wounded at heart, for his face and the change in his color disclosed the anguish of his soul. You wouldn't see writing like this at all in 1 Maccabees. This kind of elegance and sort of emotional elaboration, this is just totally nothing like what we read in 1 Maccabees. For terror and bodily trembling had come over the man, which plainly showed to those who looked at him the pain lodged in his heart, and on and on and on. Another trick that the writer uses is he slows down the action to maximize the tension and the moment of climactic salvation that's about to come. So everybody's flipping out. Heliodorus is about to take everything out of the Jerusalem temple. This is not just, you know, economically devastating, but this is a horrible violation of the sanctity of the space. But what happens? A great miracle happens. Heliodorus shows up at the treasury with his bodyguard, and then he sees a miraculous vision. Then and there, the sovereign of spirits and of all authority caused so great a manifestation. So basically he sees some miraculous vision, that all who had been so bold as to accompany Heliodorus were astounded by the power of God. No, not by the power of the Hasmoneans, because God is the hero of this story. They become faint with terror. Why? What do they see? For there appeared to them a magnificently caparisoned horse, some sort of army military horse, with a rider frightening mien. It rushed furiously at Heliodorus and struck at him with its front hose. Now, this is like a crazy, scary angel horse who just starts charging at Heliodorus and his men. But then 2 young men also appear to him, remarkably strong, gloriously beautiful, and splendidly dressed. and they stand on either side of him and they just beat him up. They flog him continuously. So here are two like highly good looking angel men who beat up Heliodorus. And then there's this giant, magnificent military horse who's attacking him. I mean, this whole thing is a miraculous vision. Heliodorus runs off terrified and humiliated and never makes it into the temple treasury. And of course, this vignette nicely encapsulates the entire story of the war. Again, there are a lot of stories like this in 2 Maccabees, all kinds of miracles. And yet it might surprise you that one famous miracle is not in this story. And that of course is the miracle of the oil. And I would posit that if the author of 2 Maccabees knew the tradition about the oil lasting for 8 days, it would certainly have made it into his book. So I don't think that the writer of 2 Maccabees knew about this legend, but we're going to see some other sources that suggest that there was a tradition about miraculous light circulating, but not in 2 Maccabees. So I don't think that 2 Maccabees has this story, but there are lots of other miracles in this work, and they all function to theologize the story. It's not really a story about the valor and the strength and the bravery of the Hashmonaim. It's really a story about God's eternal care for the Jewish people. And that allows the author of 2 Maccabees to make a case to all Jews, wherever they live, to say, this is something you need to care about. This is something that you have a stake in. In fact, the climax of the book in chapter 7, right in the middle of the book, is the earliest version that we have of the mother, who's not named in this version, the mother of 7 sons, who encourages her sons to martyr themselves rather than to violate their dietary restrictions. Antiochus IV Epiphanes tells each one of them to violate these laws, and they refuse. In the Second Temple period, when this is written, the question of martyrdom is an open question. Of course, the rabbis would later say, you should violate your ancestral laws rather than be killed, unless it's, you know, one of 3 major things. But dietary law is not one of those 3 things. And so this is an interesting passage, because it suggests that in the 2nd century BC, some Jews were saying, no, you should martyr yourself even for something like dietary law. So this is actually not what we would call proto-rabbinic. But in any case, this story is interesting for many reasons. There are a few historical nuggets. I didn't include the whole chapter because it's very long, but you could easily find this online. But one of the interesting little pieces about this story is that to antagonize Antiochus IV Epiphanes, the author, who's writing in Greek and probably does not know Hebrew, tells us that the mother spoke to her sons in Hebrew so that the king would not understand. And of course, this enrages him. Another interesting thing about this story is that it's one of the earliest really developed articulations of a belief in resurrection, which we do not see in the Hebrew Bible. Aside from a few stories in Yechezkel, in Daniel, resurrection is not a fully developed idea in the early biblical period. And yet in chapter 7 of 2 Maccabees, the mother says to her youngest son, go, let yourself be killed, because I know that God is going to restore your soul to your body. And this is a very, very developed idea of resurrection. And so this is an important document because it suggests that this idea is coming to its full articulation in the 2nd century BC. So 2 Maccabees is a very important work theologically. And I worry when people dismiss it to me and they say, well, it's diasporan, it's not an eyewitness to the story. It doesn't, you know, the author obviously wasn't there, but that's not the point. The point is that the author is doing theological work in interpreting the story in a certain way that does have profound cultural significance, right? That there's resurrection here, that there are discussions about martyrdom. But for our purposes, I want to talk about how influential the establishment of the holiday is in this work. It actually looks very different from how the holiday is established in 1 Maccabees, because in 2 Maccabees, this is not a new holiday. It's not a new holiday. What is this holiday? Well, again, we're told it happened on the same day on which this sanctuary had been profaned. So just like in 1 Maccabees, yes, the sanctuary was violated on the 25th of Kislev 3 years earlier. And so it does seem again that the Hashanim are selecting this date because it's a significant date. Remember what I said about Chagai? This is the date on which the foundation of the Second Temple is laid. Great. That's a parallel. the purification of the sanctuary took place on the 25th day of Kislev. Now, this is new. They celebrated it for 8 days with rejoicing in the manner of the Festival of Booths. Why? Well, the author gives us an interesting reason. Sukkot in December. Not simply because they hadn't properly celebrated Sukkot this year. Of course, they hadn't properly celebrated any of the holidays over the past 3 years. But because they're likening themselves to the Israelites. So again, it's not, I've heard people say, well, it's because that was the most recent holiday and they hadn't celebrated Sukkot in the temple. Okay, but you know, what about Pesach? Why don't they call it the Festival of Unleavened Bread in December? It's more than that. It's because they remembered how not long before, during the Festival of Booths, they'd been wandering in the mountains and caves like wild animals. And so they see themselves as the new Israelites. Now, it's interesting that the author writes how not long before. It's 1,000 years before. It's like me saying, you know, I've been thinking about the Crusades lately, and I just feel like this just happened and nobody's properly talking about it. 1,000 years is a long time. But the fact that this is a polemical argument that the Hasmoneans, the Hashmoneim, are running from the Seleucid Greeks in the Judean wilderness, in the Judean desert outside of Jerusalem, thinking about themselves as the Israelites who had escaped Egypt, but not yet established their hegemony in the land of Israel in the proper way. They see themselves as Israelites. And as Israelites, they are beneficiaries of the covenantal promises of God. And so this is Sukkot in December. They carry ivy wreath wands and beautiful branches and fronds of palm. They offer thanksgiving to God. Now, this, I think, is doing two things. Ivy wreath wands absolutely invokes the holiday of Dionysus, Greek holidays that the author is symbolically co-opting to make Jewish. But also, if you look at how Nehemiah in Parak Chet reestablishes the community when he rebuilds the walls around Jerusalem in the very early years of the Second Temple period, Nehemiah and Ezra and Nehemiah Parak Chet read the Torah to the people, and then right afterwards they celebrate Sukkot. And Nehemiah at the end of that chapter says, go take indigenous objects from the land and build your Sukkot. And the people seem to be reading Vayikra Chaf Gimel, Parak Mem Mem Aleph Mem Bet, which says to take various fruits and plants and use them to celebrate and build Sukkot. And so there is some association here between the holiday of the Festival of Booths and what they do over here. There seems to be some scriptural awareness of this association that they're carrying ivy wreath wands and beautiful branches and fronds of palm. So it's, you know, like Hoshana almost, but again, in December, in Kislev. So now we have two totally different accounts of this holiday. Neither text tells us about the miracle of the oil, but that doesn't mean that they're not theologically interested in the meaning of the story. It's absolutely the case that two Maccabees, again, written towards the end of the second century BCE, is thinking very carefully about what this means covenantally, theologically, and much less interested in the military details of the war and the fealty, the loyalty that one should or should not have for the Hashmonai family. Now, it does seem, and I'm not looking at your comments. I see that people are posting questions, but I'm not going to click on the chat yet, but I am going to try to leave time for some discussion. It does seem, though, that at a very early stage, there are stories about miraculous light that are associated with this holiday. And I'm going to bring you to our friend Josephus. Josephus Flavius, late first century CE historian, gets a bad rap as unreliable. I will be happy to discuss that if anybody's curious about how we use Josephus, his manner of reliability. For now, I just want to say a few things. Josephus, of course, is born in Judea to an aristocratic priestly family. He is assigned the role of general over a small garrison in the northern region of Judea in 69 CE, a little while after the war breaks out, the rebellion against the Roman Empire. Josephus is an utter disaster as a general. All of his men at the site of Jotapata are killed. He hides, ultimately is taken captive by Vespasian, a general who is soon going to become emperor, taken to Rome in chains because he had predicted to Vespasian that he would become emperor. Again, that might be apocryphal, but this is what Josephus tells us. Vespasian in 69, treats Josephus very, very well. In fact, brings him back to Jerusalem in the middle of the war to act as a translator. You can imagine how people felt seeing their compatriot working for the Romans. They did not like that. And Josephus, after the war, ends up in Rome, taken very good care of by his patron, the Flavius family, commissioned to write a number of works. And here are his works. He writes an autobiography, Vita, which in Latin means life. He writes the first systematic defense of the Jewish religion to ever have been written against Appian. Very important work that doesn't get enough attention, in my opinion. He writes a 7-volume account of the war, aptly called the Jewish War. And he writes a magisterial 20-volume work called Antiquities of the Jews, which retells Jewish history from the very beginning of Genesis, of Bereshit. Now, in both the Jewish War and Antiquities, Josephus talks about the Hasmoneans. In the Jewish War, he talks about the conflict between the Hasmonaim and the Seleucid Greeks because he wants to lay out the foundation for the relationship between Judean Jews and Rome. And it's in the 2nd century BCE, right after the war with the Greeks, that Judeans first make a treaty with the Roman Empire. Of course, that treaty is not long-lasting. But so we have some information about the Hasmonaim in the Jewish War, where Josephus probably has 1 Maccabees, maybe has other sources as well, retells the details of the war. I'm not going to go through it here. In Antiquities of the Jews, in book 12, Josephus says something very, very interesting. He gives the commemoration of the holiday a name. So he says, here are all the details of the war, and he goes into a lot of detail. So he certainly has some sources that we probably don't have. But then he says, but here's a name. Here's a name for the holiday that we celebrate for 8 days in Kislev. And that holiday is called Lights. So he's writing in the 90 CE, and he says, the holiday is called Lights. They were so very glad at the revival of their customs when after a long time of intermission, they unexpectedly had regained the freedom of their worship. They made it a law for their posterity to keep a festival for 8 days. And from that time to this, we celebrate this festival and call it Lights. Now, what's so sort of delicious about this source is that he has no clue as to why it's called Lights. It's an utter mystery to Josephus. And it's very fun when you get a little bit of humility from ancient historians when they say things like, you know, I just have no idea what's going on over here. I mean, he really doesn't know. So this is the end of the 1st century. By now, Chanukah is well established. It's not called Chanukah probably. Chagurim Sameach, you know, I think that's what Jay said at the beginning of the talk. Maybe that's the oldest appellate for the holiday. So we're already talking, I'm not great at math, but we're already talking easily about 250 years after the war. So by Josephus's time, this is ancient history. This is like me talking about the Revolutionary War. He doesn't have the origin of the name. He only has the name itself. And then he has to sort of fudge around and try to think up a name. I suppose the reason was maybe it was called Lights because this liberty beyond our hopes appeared to us. And that thence was the name given to that festival. I think that that's a load of, you know what? I don't think that Josephus has any idea why it's called Lights because all he's doing is allegorizing this in a very general way. Yeah, it was metaphorically dark, but then it got metaphorically light. You know what? You could do that with any good story in the biblical canon. You know, yesterday I lost my keys and that was like a real allegorical darkness for me, but then I found my keys. And so then it was allegorical light. So I'm going to call December 15th henceforth my miracle of light. It doesn't really work. And I think Josephus knows. I think Josephus knows that this is far too allegorical, but then why? So how can, is it possible to discern why, by the end of the first century CE, the Jews are calling this holiday lights. Is there a better reason than the one that Josephus offers? It doesn't seem that the books of 1 Maccabees or 2 Maccabees provide us with any hints as to why there would have been this association between Hanukkah and lights. You could go back to Haggai and maybe the prophecy of Zechariah. And Yoel Ben Nun has very famously written about this, and Menachem Liebtag, the association between the temple and the menorah and the 25th of Kislev, upon which the second temple, the foundations of the second temple are laid. But I think that there's actually something else going on here. And in order to understand it, we need to look at two ancient letters. And these ancient letters are appended, they're editorially attached to the book of 2 Maccabees. So they're not written by the author of 2 Maccabees, but in the first century BCE, an editor or a scribe is copying over the work of 2 Maccabees and has these letters and attaches them to the work. And remember when I said, I'm going to scroll up for a second. Remember when I said that this story about Heliodorus in 2 Maccabees is at the beginning of the book? Well, close readers would have noticed when I said the beginning of the book, it's in chapter 3. How is that really the beginning of the book? Because the first two chapters are not 2 Maccabees. The first two chapters, if you open up any work of 2 Maccabees, are actually ancient letters that have thematic connections to 2 Maccabees, but were written later and by different people. And let's look at these letters because I think that they're very significant. The first letter is a letter written by leaders in Jerusalem. And it's dated, which is incredible. It's always fun when an ancient letter is dated. Leaders in Jerusalem are writing this letter to Jews living in Egypt. Now, remember, 2 Maccabees is writing for a diaspora audience, engaging in a marketing campaign to convince them to observe Hanukkah for perpetuity. And in this letter, we have a similar marketing campaign. And this is really quite beautiful. The original language scholars believe is Aramaic. Or possibly Hebrew, but not Greek. And there are Semiticisms. In other words, it's preserved in Greek, but you can tell that if you were to back translate it into Hebrew, it would work much better. For example, in Hebrew and Aramaic letters, you start with the writers and then you name the audience. But in Greek letters, you name the audience and then you identify yourself. So there are like interesting little hints that tell us pretty confidently that this was originally written in Aramaic or possibly Hebrew. Greetings and true peace. May God do good to you, and may he remember his covenant with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, his faithful servants. May he give you all a heart to worship him and to do his will with a strong heart and a willing spirit. May he open your heart to his law and his commandments. And here I see a little undertone of rebuke, right? There's kinship, there's friendship, there's connection. And yet the Judean leaders are saying to the diaspora and Jews, remember where you come from. Remember who you are. May he open your heart to his law, right? So you're in a situation where you are exposed and vulnerable to certain influences. Remember yourselves. Remember your ancestors are not the Greeks, right? But they're Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. So may God open your heart to his law. May he hear your prayers. May he be reconciled to you. Again, this is an open scholarly debate. Is there rebuke here? I think that there actually probably is. Some scholars say, no, it's all hearts and flowers. In any case, this letter cites an older letter written in 143 BCE. In the reign of Demetrius in the 169th year, remember, we're counting down from 311 BCE from the beginning of the Seleucid period. We Jews wrote to you in the critical distress that came upon us. I'm not going to go into all the history here, but we wrote to you and we were having some problems with Jason and his goons in 143 BCE. There was intra-Jewish fighting in Judea in 143 BCE. We wrote to you then, and now 20 years later in 124 BCE, we're writing to you again. At that time, 20 years ago, we prayed to the Lord. We were heard. We offered sacrifice and grain offerings. We lit the lamps. We set up the loaves. And now, see that you keep the festival of booths in the month of Kislev in the 188th year in 124 BCE. Keep Sukkot in December, right? This is exactly like the end of 2 Maccabees. It's not like 1 Maccabees, which is a new holiday, which is totally based on a military victory galvanized by the successful Hashmonaim. No, this goes back all the way to the festival of booths, to Sukkot. It's an ancient holiday that now has renewed meaning, perhaps, but it's been connected to the biblical history of the people. So putting that on the back burner for a second, I want to introduce the second letter to you and show you that in both of these letters, written by different people, I think, in both of these letters, the argument is that diasporan Jews have a theological stake in the story. And on that basis, they have to keep the holiday of Hanukkah. But it's in this letter that we finally find what we are looking for. We finally find a little allusion, a little hint towards a miracle of light. And so this story, I think, is highly, highly significant. It's set in 164 BC, but there are some historical possible errors that make scholars think that it could be a forgery written in the end of the second century BC. But it is attributed to none other than Judah Maccabee. The people of Jerusalem and of Judea and the Senate, the Gerousia in Greek, and Judas, maybe Judah Maccabee, because again, we're going to see the 164 BCE date. So this would have been right after the war, but I put 103 or 102 because many scholars say that this is actually written a little later. To Aristobulus, who is of the family of the anointed priest, so a priestly Jew, but living in the diaspora, teacher of King Ptolemy, and to the king, and to the Jews in Egypt, greetings and good health. And again, we actually know something about Aristobulus because he's mentioned in some other sources too. He was probably a very aristocratic Jewish leader living in Egypt. And in order to understand this letter, it's important to note, by this time, there are hundreds of thousands of Jews living in Egypt. Egypt is not a tiny Jewish community. Outside of Judea and maybe eastern regions of what becomes Sasani and Persia, the most robust concentration of Jewish life is taking place in Egypt. It's not such a fun thought because we think of Egypt through the lens of what we're told in Devarim. This is the theological opposite of the land of Israel. You can never go back there. You can never settle there. But the reality is very different. The reality is that there are easily 250,000 Jews in Alexandria alone. It is the New York City of the ancient world. It's teeming with Jewish life and teeming with Jewish culture. And I want you to leave aside any binary that you have between authentic Judean Judaism and Hellenized diasporan Judaism, because these Jews in Egypt mostly were pious Jews. They were observing their ancestral laws, by which I mean the Sabbath, dietary laws, circumcision, gathering together to read the scriptures regularly. In other words, you are not talking about Hellenized Jews. The vast majority of those who identify as Jews in Egypt are observing their ancestral laws. And so put aside this binary of Hellenism versus Judaism that is so influential, but devised into Maccabees. And let's look at this letter. So this letter is very complicated because it's a series of vignettes that move farther and farther back into the biblical period. But it opens up with an exhortation. On the 25th day of Kislev, we shall celebrate the purification of the temple. We thought it necessary to notify you in case that you also may celebrate the Festival of Booths. Wow, Festival of Booths again. So we had that in the first letter. We had that in 2 Maccabees. But also the Festival of Fire. Fire? What is this Festival of Fire? Even you can't even find that in, you know, the Haggai and Zechariah material. What is the Festival of Fire? Okay, so now the author has a story to tell the diasporan audience. It's a very important story. And this story suggests that the Hashmonai victory over the Syrian Greeks in 164 BC is merely a continuation of a series of victories that take place in the temple that have a connection with miraculous fire. And the first story that the writer tells is this. This is what you need to know, the writer says. When our ancestors at the beginning of the Babylonian period, so from 597 to 586 BCE, are being led captive to Babylonia, they say Persia, but this is the Babylonian exile, of course. What happened when the Judeans were being kicked out of Jerusalem and the temple is falling, the city's up in flames? The pious priests of that time took fire from the altar and they secretly hid it before they went into forced exile. They hid fire from the temple. Now, many years passed, the Babylonian exile comes to an end, the Persians have taken over Babylonia, Cyrus permits the Judeans in exile to return, and a few generations, many are returning under the leadership of Nehemiah. And what does Nehemiah do? He knows the story of the fire. He's aware somehow that there is a story that priests on their way out of Judea had hidden fire from the temple. And he says to priests around him. Now, we don't exactly know the date of Nehemiah. Is this the end of the 6th century BC? Is this later? But it doesn't matter for our purposes. He says to some priests, look, we're coming back to Judea. I want you to find this fire. Go find the fire and we'll use it to kindle the newly established temple. And so they do. They find this fire that had been hidden, but it's not fire anymore. It's only a thick liquid. And so Nehemiah says, you know what? Put it on the altar. Let's see if something happens. Let's put this thick liquid, it's not fire, but let's put this thick liquid on the altar and see what happens. And so they do. And after some time passes and the sun rises up in the sky, a miracle happens. A great fire blazes up so that all marvel. And this is taken as a sign that God has approved of the project to restore Jerusalem and that Nehemiah is doing all the right things and the correct person to lead this process of restoration. And the high priest, Yonatan, leads the people in a wonderful prayer that seems to have nothing to do with this miracle. It's a prayer which hopes for the ingathering of all the exiles. And when he utters this prayer, right, gather together our scattered people, again, seems to have very little to do with the actual miracle at hand, but imagine being an Egyptian Jew receiving this letter and reading it. The message to the Egyptian Jews reading this letter is, you are the recipients of God's covenantal promises, because God has brought an ingathering of exiles back to Judea and restored them. Likewise, he will do the same for you if you return. So we have this whole story. And the theological message again is, even those in exile are recipients of God's covenantal promises. So in any case, when all this is done, a flame blazed up, the light from the altar shone back, it went out. When this matter became known, it was reported to the Persians. Even the king says, wow, this is a major miracle. But in the author's attempt to retroject the victory of the Hashmonaim back into the biblical period, he doesn't end with Nehemiah. He goes farther back into older history. And he says, actually, the story about Nehemiah and the miraculous light actually starts with Yirmiyahu, because guess what? Yirmiyahu, working at the end of the 7th century and beginning of the 6th century BC, Yirmiyahu was the one, the very person who told the priests to hide that fire. And so in fact, the story begins at the end of the first temple period, when Yirmiyahu, that great prophet, says to the Jews, leaving for exile, take this fire and hide it. And of course, if you know about Yirmiyahu, you know that he actually ends up in Egypt with a community of Jews because there's strife and he's being treated very badly in Judea. But in any case, so there's this connection between Yirmiyahu and the Jews of Egypt, and maybe the writers of the letter are perceiving the Jews in Egypt as descendants of that community that goes down with Yirmiyahu. That's a speculation, but I think it's very possible. But then the letter writer says, actually, the story doesn't end or begin with Yirmiyahu, but it goes all the way back to the time of Shlomo, because Shlomo dedicated the temple. And after he dedicates the temple, they bring sacrifices that are miraculously accepted. And then they celebrate. They celebrate the story of Sukkot in Malachim Aleph Perichet. But actually, the author says, it doesn't even start with Shlomo. It starts with Moshe. It starts with Moses himself, who gave us the laws regarding these celebrations. And so what is the argument of this very complicated, the structurally complicated letter, is that what we're doing, what we're celebrating on the 25th of Kislev, it's not merely a commemoration of the victory of a war which occurred for some Jews in 164 BC, but we're celebrating the continuous manifestation of divine care for the people, a care which is manifest specifically in these light miracles, and these miracles that are manifest through miraculous fire on the temple. So this is totally new, right? We don't see this in 1 Maccabees. We don't see it in 2 Maccabees. But, you know, one of the big ideas about this letter is that there is no reference to the Hashmonaim outside of the actual reference to the writer Judah, who may or may not be Judah Maccabee. The actual letter totally takes them out of the picture. This is not a story about the Hashmonaim. This is a story about God's care for the people. In fact, the letter writer says that explicitly. Since we're about to celebrate the purification, we write to you, will you therefore keep the days? It is God. In other words, if you're going to say it's the Hashmonaim who saved the people, then you could say maybe it doesn't have so much to do with you. It's a regional conflict and there was a regional resolution. But no, the author says, that's not what it is. It's not a regional conflict with a regional resolution. It's God who saved all his people and has returned the inheritance to all. And you have a stake in it. This matters to all of us. Like I said at the beginning of this talk, today it was us and tomorrow it can be you. Now, of course, we all know that in the rabbinic period, the rabbis really de-emphasized the military aspect of the holiday. We have a reference to it in this famous Mai Chanukah passage preserved in the Tractate Shabbat. When the Greeks entered the temple, they defiled the oil and the Hashemite made search and could only find one cruse of oil. And a miracle was wrought and lasted for 8 days. And there are many reasons that have been suggested regarding why the rabbis are not interested in valorizing the Hashemite. The most simple explanation is usually the correct explanation. And I think that the rabbis have a distaste for military rebellion following the disasters of 66 to 73 CE, the War of Quietus, which is a little known rebellion that the Jews greatly suffer from in 115 to 118 CE, the very famous Bar Kokhba rebellion in 132 to 135 CE. The Jews are rebelling under Roman occupation, probably with this idea of what God did for the Hashemite in ancient times, right, 175 to 164 BC, God will do that again for us and throw the yoke of Rome off. But it doesn't happen, right? The Jews keep trying to effect another Hanukkah story. They remember and they retell the Hanukkah story in the rabbinic period, and they rebel with this sort of a very well-developed imaginative narrative that God will do this whenever we rebel. And of course, that's not the story. There's incredible devastation following each of these rebellions. And by the second and third centuries, the rabbis say enough. The rabbis are no longer going to valorize such rebels. And of course, they have a very complicated relationship with some of them, such as Bar Kokhba. But there are hints of the military story that resurface in the early medieval period. And here I'm going to wrap up to make sure that we have time for questions. The liturgy of the Shmona Esrei, which we say on All 8 Days of Hanukkah, the earliest references to this liturgy is in prayer books dated to the early medieval period. So I wouldn't call it rabbinic, but maybe early medieval. These texts, especially the one that I have on the screen over here, does absolutely bring the military conflict to the foreground. And so you might say that the rabbis did a very bad job suppressing the military story because it resurfaces again. And this is the narrative that wins the day, right? I mean, we tell this story every time we daven this prayer, all 8 days of Hanukkah. And so maybe the narrative of the military victory does win the day, in which case one Maccabees does sort of win over two Maccabees, except look at this story closely, and I'll do the Hebrew if that's okay. In the days of Matityahu, or I'll just sort of highlight, B'mei Matityahu ben Yochanan Kohen Gadol Hashmonai v'Nav, okay, in the days of Matityahu, the high priest, the Hashmonai and his sons, okay, all right. Okay, when the kingdom of Greece, the evil kingdom, came upon your nation Israel, so it's not just the people in Judea or in Jerusalem, it's all people have a stake in the story. What did you do, God? You won the war for the Hashmonaim, Ravta et Rivam, Danta et Dinam, Nakamta et Nikmatam, right? You fought their battle. You judged their judgment. You avenged their avengement. Masarta Giborim Be'achalashim. So what's the argument here? It's actually an undermining of one Maccabees. Yes, the Maccabees were the warriors, but they were merely tools in the hands of God, right? You, God, you fought the battle. You judged their judgment. You avenged their avengement. So even today, as we retell the story and the Hashmonaim are this great example of courage and piety and strength, we say this prayer to remind ourselves that actually this is a story about divine omnipotence, divine interest in all of Yisrael and all of the Jewish people, regardless of where they live, whether it's in Judea or outside of the land of Israel. God has equal care and concern for all people. And therefore, this story has relevance to all Jews everywhere in all generations. And so, in fact, I believe that this document undermines the message of One Maccabees, which depicts this war as a regional war and the commemoration holiday as one which focuses specifically at that one moment in time. This liturgical passage says no, there's a transcendence to the story which makes it applicable to all Jews. we have, I'm not going to go into the Christian text because we don't have time, but we have a very interesting little line preserved in Pesik Rabbati in early medieval Midrash, which fuses the military and the theological stories into one in a very elegant little one line. Why do we celebrate, why do we kindle lights on Hanukkah? Because when the family, the Hashmonaim, the high priest, defeated the Hellenists, they entered the temple and they found 8 iron spears and they stuck candles on them and they lit them. And so in this tradition, the Hashmonaim are transforming these dangerous weapons that are used to threaten not just their lives, but their religious integrity. And they're transforming them and reversing them and elevating them to worship God and recognize God's covenantal care for the people. So here I'm going to stop share. I see that there are some comments. Again, I haven't had a chance to look at those comments. But I do want to end with the suggestion that I think it's very, very possible that there was an ancient story. I think I'm convinced that there were ancient stories circulating at a very, very early stage, right after the war, which associated the victory of the Hashmonaim with a miraculous story having to do with light in the temple, and that these stories are circulating so compellingly and powerfully that by the end of the first century, by the time Josephus is writing about this holiday, it's already very well established, so well established that the holiday is called Lights, and he does not even know why. Okay, with that, I want to make sure that we have some time for questions. So Rabbi Kalman, I'm not sure what your procedure is here. Do you want to take questions or should
okay,
I just...
Okay, so normally we just go through the chat box. Either you can do it yourself or I can feed you the questions if that's easier for you. And then if people want to chime in, they can unmute themselves and ask. So if you see the questions, you can take a look at the questions. I'll just let everybody know. I want to, first of all, thank you very much for a very fascinating share, bringing history to life and to light. So thank you for that really exploration into the whole development of Hanukkah. 2:15 this afternoon, it's in about just over 2 hours, Lori Novick will be giving us your Men, Women, and the Ritual of Hanukkah, Halal v'Hodah. She's been giving, as you know, a 13-part series on women and ritual. Today's really a 14th part. And that part she'll do on Hanukkah. And then this evening, 8 p.m., our weekly shiur on the Haftorah of the week. And so it won't be specifically on Hanukkah. Moshe Sokolov, that's this evening at 8 p.m. Tomorrow, Daniel Schwartz, professor at Hebrew University, will be giving a talk on Antiochus' decrees, Hersian Orthodoxy, and German Jewry on the eve of the Holocaust. And in our rotating Parsha shiur, tomorrow night, Miketz, it's actually my turn. I'll be giving the shiur tomorrow night at 8:30. So everybody's welcome, and we look forward to learning with you. Okay, Kimalka, hopefully by now you weren't paying attention to me and had a chance to look at the questions.
Well, they're mostly very astute comments, and I thank those who commented for their insights. It doesn't seem to me like there's a question being posted, but, you know, I welcome everybody. You know, these are interesting comments, nothing that I feel like I need to answer. But if anybody has a question, maybe this would be a good time to either ask or to put it into the chat box.
The only semi-question from Morris, and that's actually something that was the focus of beginning of Rabbi Liebtag's talk on Sunday, was the Gemara of Avodah Zarah, that a winter solstice festival, Adam HaRishon making and tying into Hanukkah. But that's prehistorical, if you want to call it that, prehistorical. Okay, if anybody has any questions, you want to unmute themselves, Bakasha?
How come that Josephus
we don't hear you
about Maccabees? My question is, how come Josephus was seemed to be unaware of the two books of Maccabees?
He probably has one Maccabees. Two Maccabees is circulating, like I said, in Greek in the diaspora, and it's a live academic question about what his sources are, but it's very possible, you're correct, that he might not have had two Maccabees.
I mean, isn't that, that's possible?
I'm sorry?
Isn't it?
I don't hear. But feel free to put it in the chat.
I mean, he's a scholar, and he has...
I don't hear.
I'm saying... So you're not coming through so clearly, Yarsha.
Oh, I'm sorry. It's just, it's odd that he didn't have access to these books.
It's very, very likely that he had one Maccabees, and it's possible he had two Maccabees. But he's using 1 Maccabees as a historical document because that's what he is purporting. That's what he's claiming to do. So he's maybe less interested in the miracles as told in 2 Maccabees, but it does seem like he's depending on 1 Maccabees and possibly other sources that have been lost to us.
I heard a podcast earlier today, and Larry Fishman said that Josephus more or less incorporated all of 1 Maccabees.
Yes, I mean, he uses it uncritically. Yes. Now, but again, the question is, like, does he have anything else? So, you know, it's an interesting question, but absolutely he's highly dependent on 1 Maccabees. Yeah. Yeah. Josephus is not the kind of writer who's going to be using the story of Heliodorus with the angels who are beating him up. I mean, that's probably not going to be useful to his project.
I had a question, if it's okay.
Bakasha?
Okay. So I've been fascinated by this and just all that I've been able to do in terms of reading. But to just flip this around from the Greek perspective, were they just being Greek? And, you know, because if you go to Athens, you see there the Acropolis and Zeus. And so were they just doing what Greeks do in terms of in the temple? Or they say we're going to defile the temple?
When you say they, are you talking about Jews?
The Greeks.
So you're not talking about Hellenized Jews. You're talking about the actual Seleucid Greeks.
The actual Greeks. In other words, if you go to Athens, you see the Acropolis and you see the Acropolis is beautiful, right? It's the way it might have looked at the time. So were they setting out to, like, we're going to defile the temple in Jerusalem? Or they just, we want to make it like it was in Athens? I'm just wondering the context of it.
Well, this is a huge debate among scholars, is why did Antiochus IV Epiphanes invade? And again, you know, we have to remember that the Judeans are under Hellenistic occupation as of 323 BC, and things are okay. Now, most of that time, they're under Ptolemaic Hellenistic occupation, and the Ptolemies have no interest in being hands-on with Judea. They very much practice religious tolerance. The problem is when power sort of shifts and the Seleucid kingdom incorporates in 200 BCE Judea into their kingdom, and there's a totally different dynamic. And so why does he invade is a big question. Now, there are two sort of theories. Elias Bickerman has a very influential theory that Antiochus IV Epiphanes perceived there to be a civil war in Judea, or a civil conflict that he had to quell. And the way that he sort of quashes it is very, very, very heavy-handed. It could simply be that like many Hellenists in the second century BC, he had great antagonism towards Judeans because they weren't properly integrating into the umbrella of Hellenistic culture, but they wanted all the benefits of Hellenistic culture. And so we see a real rise in anti-Jewish literature in the second century BC, which argue that Jews are practicing things that are barbaros, that are foreign, like from the word barbarian. And they want all the benefits of being in the Hellenistic empire, but they're not participating in public life, which of course, public civic life is religious life. So when Jews don't go to the festival of Dionysus, that's an affront, that's an insult to Hellenism, and it makes them bad Greeks. Right. And so there are these two theories. Does he have like a personal vendetta against these people who refuse to be good team players? Or does he perceive there to be a civil conflict that he has to quash? And he does so sort of in the way that Vespasian uses that as an excuse in 69, when he comes in with such a heavy hand and he says, well, you know, he sort of, he markets himself as putting down a civil conflict, even though that's not really what's going on.
Right. Let me just one other variation, because I know there's a Greek aesthetic, right? And if you look at any of their statues or Zeus, I mean, the human body is like, so you can see why they would be, from a cultural point of view, against circumcision because of the aesthetic of the human body. To them, it's like you're destroying beauty. They're from that approach. So I'm just trying to wrap my head around, like,
But I think that's part of what I was saying, in the sense that they are barbaros, right? They're foreign. They're practicing things that are outside of our sophisticated modern society. And they were very resentful. And you know, the big three identifying markers of Jewish practice at this time, Sabbath, circumcision, dietary law, each of these things confounded the Greeks. The Sabbath, they said, you know, Jews are lazy, Seneca says in the first century, that they need to rest 1/7 of the time. Dietary laws, they're misanthropic. Misanthropia is a Greek word. They're anti-people. They won't have table fellowship with us. And of course, circumcision, yes, they're mutilating themselves. when they should be striving for the perfection of the soul and perfection of the body at the same time. So I think you're 100% right. And I think that that sentiment is rising in the second century BC. We don't have evidence that Antiochus for Epiphanes is articulating that resentment, but I suspect that he knows of it and maybe foments the resentment that he knows exists among the public. And I think you're right, but I also think it could be both.
Right. So my last thing, did Maimonides put all this stuff aside? That's what I'm trying to figure out also.
Did Philo of Alexandria? I mean, you're talking about like this.
All this whole, I mean, he loved Aristotle. And I mean, I'm just the whole Greek thing. So did he just compartmentalize? How did he like sort of like get around these things?
You know, I really think that the Jews had a love affair with Hellenism when it was there and even after it was there. I don't think it's fair to use this, the rabbinic phrase, in every generation they try to kill us in such a way as to deny the ways in which Jews thrived under Hellenism. And I don't want to sound heretical because there was a war and it was bad and people suffered. But the Hellenistic period starts in 323 and it ends in 63 BCE. That's a long time. It's very, very different than the Roman occupation of Judea, which is pretty much from the beginning, broken, dysfunctional, and racked with pain. So Rome is very different than Greece. And the relationship that Jews have with Greece is very, very complex. And I wouldn't characterize it correctly. I wouldn't be fair to say it's just all negative.
Okay.
Got to wrap up.
No, go. Yeah, it's just, I don't want to keep you too long, but thank you very much. Really, I think that's a whole other shiur, the Rambam's view and Greek, and I think you summed it up perfectly. We have a complex relationship, which, we view Hanukkah very often as a simplistic holiday. So in Jews, you'd like to know, you eat latkes, ufganiyot, have a nice time, Christmas presents, the whole American way. And it's such a deep and complex holiday. So I want to thank you and be well. And I got an hour behind in Chicago. So really glad we could have you back. And we look forward to learning.